beautiful song. If I'm not mistaken, Squire Parsons, I know he sang it and he may have written it. And that's always a blessing whenever you hear it. Well, 2 Samuel chapter 12, we will finish that chapter this evening. I've entitled the message tonight, Wag the Dog. Wag the Dog. Now, some of you remember that phrase. It's a phrase that came into being back in the late 90s. And it is a way of saying that you have something that happens in public that overshadows something that is going on in private that you're trying to hide. And I think that's kind of the situation that we have tonight. It may not be a fully wag the dog situation, but it's pretty close to it. I can't help but think that David is excited about it, because the story tonight draws attention from David, the sins that he committed, the consequences of those sins. And so you see that the change in narrative tonight is one that I think David looks upon maybe with a little bit of happiness. Because for the last little bit of time, the joy of the Lord has departed from him. He has had an old bony-fingered prophet stick his finger in his face and let him know that he was guilty. We see that one of the judgments that has befallen him, this will not be the only judgment, there are at least three more to come. We will pick up on some of those next time. But we see that tonight, with all of those things that have previously been happening, we see that tonight it's as though, at least publicly, people are going to look at David in maybe a little better light. The siege of Rabbah had lasted probably for close to 2 years by this time. Now, when you look at the passage, we're only coming in now at the end of chapter 12, and the siege of Rabbah began in 1 Samuel chapter 11, or 2 Samuel chapter 11. And so for about 2 years now, the city has been under siege. And so as we have gone through this chapter, it's almost as though it's a literary style that the writer of Samuel is using, where that he talks about the siege in chapter 11, verse 1, but then he immediately flips it and it becomes a private matter or a secretive type matter when David is walking around on top of the house. Well, now, basically, everything has been about David. Everything has been about his sin. Everything has been about the birth of that baby, Uriah being killed, all of those things. But tonight, the writer of Samuel flips the coin over once more, and we're back at something that's public. We're back at the siege. Between the beginning of this siege and tonight, two babies have been born. You've got a baby that died, which was the first child of David and Bathsheba, the one that was conceived in the sin of adultery. There's a second child that was born, and that child's name was Solomon, also known as Jedediah. And so you've got two babies that are born, so we're talking probably somewhere just under 2 years. And so that's where we will jump in tonight. And the first thing that I want you to see this evening is I want you to see an RSVP that's sent. If you're taking notes, there'll be 3 points. So we've got an RSVP that is sent. Look with me at verse 26. And Joab, you remember Joab, he's the general, all right? He got to be the general because he was the first to climb Warren's shaft when they were taking the city of Jerusalem. Joab fought against Reba and of the children of Ammon and took the royal city. So what you have is you've got the general, and Reba was divided by a brook, the brook Jabbok. On the lower end of it was the lower city, and then on the upper end, what some people would call the citadel, was the royal city, and that's where the king of the Ammonites, that's where he would reside. Well, the way that it seems to read is that they've taken everything below the little creek, the little water passageway called Jabbok, which was the water supply for Reba. And now the upper city is just about to fall. Now, it would seem that Joab maybe is ingratiating himself. You know, in our day, in recent times, when an enemy was about to surrender, when an enemy was about to be conquered, we didn't have our president fly over and take care of it. You usually had one of the generals that did that. You had, like in the Pacific, you had General MacArthur. And so, in ancient times, though, to make sure that the king got credit, he would come, maybe even at the last minute, which is what we're seeing here. You see, all of this time, during this two-year siege, David is residing at Jerusalem. But yet Joab, maybe seeking to ingratiate himself a little bit to David, he's not really scared of David. We'll see that later on. And maybe he's just simply building up a little bit of political capital by letting David have this accolade. And when I look at it, I almost look at it and think, why didn't David just send him back word and say, you go do it? Except that in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if David goes and he takes it, the headlines are going to be big. It's not going to be about David and his sin and consequences. It's going to be about David conquers Reba. That would be the headline in Jerusalem Times. All right? Now, you know that I'm saying that facetiously. They didn't have newspapers then. So don't go out and tell somebody that Brother Tommy thinks they had newspapers in 1000 BC. All right? So anyway, you've got an RSVP that's given, and you've got Joab, and it says he took the royal city. And this royal city is just simply the part of town that the king resided in. Verse 27. And Joab sent messengers to David. There's the RSVP that I alluded to. And said, I have fought against Reba and have taken the city of waters. He's taken that little eddy, that little creek of Jabbok. He's taken that, and he's just about to take the rest of it. But he says this, now therefore gather the rest of the people. David, bring you and your special forces and encamp against the city. In other words, come, you be with us and take it, lest I take the city and it be called after my name. So in other words, he is ingratiating himself to the king by sending the message, by RSVPing, saying, come on, I want you to have this place named after you. And so when we look at that, we see that the RSVP is sent. And so the second thing that I want us to look at tonight is I want us to see a royal ceremony. A royal ceremony. Look with me, beginning at verse 29. And David gathered all the people together and went to Reba and fought against it and took it. All right? Now, whenever I see that, I can't help but think that he didn't do a lot of fighting. That already been done. I tell you what it kind of reminds me of. I don't remember how long ago it was. I think it was maybe 10, 12 years ago. I saw a high school game, and it was videotaped. And this one team, they were just killing this other team. But on their team, they had a little guy on their team that had some type of physical infirmity, but because everybody on the team loved this kid, they just said, "You come and be on our team with us." And they were beating this other team handily. And so they brought this, basically this handicapped young man in. And somehow they got somebody to, you know, foul him softly. And they put him on the foul line. And here he is, awkward as he can be. He shoots two shots and he makes one of the shots. And everybody in the stands is going crazy. Because here this guy is, he just loves being around those ball players. And they love him. And at the end of the game, they pick him up because he's made a foul shot. And they carry him around on their shoulders. This is what I'm visualizing here. David has not really done anything to win this battle. But they're going to be giving him the credit for it. And so David gathers all of the people together. When it says people, I believe that it means those that are in his security force. And he goes to Raba and he fights against it. I don't know, who knows? Maybe he threw a spear against one gate. All right? And he takes it. And in verse 30 it says, he took their king's crown from off of his head. In ancient times, when one king defeated another king, he would basically strip him of any of the royal garb that he had. So what he did was he takes the crown, he takes the diadem that belonged to this king of Araba, the Ammonite king, and it says that the weight of this, or the weight thereof, or whereof, was a talent of gold. Well, if you do biblical measurements and weights, I think that if you run a reference on a talent, I think that you'll find it's in the neighborhood of 75 pounds. Now, that's a pretty heavy crown, all right? I mean, that's big, that weighs more than a big sack of fertilizer. Right? Now, most people, because of the weight of this, they think that the way that the throne there at Raba was structured was that it was on some type of support system that was over the king's seat. The reason that they say that is this. In England, the crown that the king and the queen of England would wear only weighed 3 pounds. And because it was 3 pounds, they could wear it some, but they didn't wear it very long. They wanted to go put it back, I guess, in its box because it was heavy. Now, when I played football a long time ago, and it was fun back then, I don't even want to play touch football now. All right? It hurt too bad the next day. Had somebody tell me the other day, said, "You know, man, if you'd get down to about 220, you could play softball again." And I'm saying, "Why?" And so, anyway, when I played football, I remember they gave us some new helmets one year. And all I'm thinking is, where's my helmet from last year? This thing is heavy. We went from plastic face masks to those that had metal in them. And so I'm doing this because it was heavy. Can you imagine a crown that weighs 75 pounds? I can't either. So they got somebody and they take this thing from off of its stand, which is where the king would sit. And perhaps they came over and laid it very gently on David's head. Maybe they had like Aaron and Hur were on each side of Moses. Maybe they had two guys on each side of it holding it up so that it wouldn't knock David in the head. But he takes that, and it's a symbolic gesture And it's also a gesture that, hey, I'm getting some money. The symbolism has to do with, we conquered you. Basically, our God's bigger than your God. So therefore, everything of material wealth that you've got, it is now ours. And the crown is David's. Well, what else does it say about the crown? It says that it had precious stones in it. Now, what is a precious stone? It would have things like a ruby. It would have things like an emerald. And it would be somehow attached to that talent of gold, that 75-pound gold crown. It would have little pieces of jewelry in it, stones that were expensive. And so when he has that, it says, and he brought forth the spoil of the city in great abundance. So these people who had been marauders and they had begun to collect things and they had accumulated much wealth, it went right by the wayside. And when I was thinking about the fact that people can gain wealth, but just as fast as you gain it, you can lose it. I remember years ago, there was a baseball player. He played for the Cardinals, and he played for the Giants a little bit. He was a big first baseman, and I won't call his name, but he played first base for the Cards and for the Giants. At that time, million-dollar contracts were a pretty big deal. Now, some of them make that in a week. But back then, he made in a year $2 to $3 million. It was a $2 to $3 million contract. He played for several years. And when he was done playing, he was $11 million in debt. I don't understand that. But you know what? He wasn't the only one. We had a basketball player in Atlanta. Made millions and millions of dollars. But he let his mother and his sister handle his money, and when he got finished playing, he didn't have any. He couldn't even buy a car on the credit. He had a brother that played in the NBA as well. He played for the Knicks. And they asked him about that. And he said, what advice did you take from the experience of your brother? He said, my mom and my sister don't handle my money. And that's exactly right. You've known of people that have made it, and you've known of people that have lost it. Whether it's an athlete or whether it's an actor, usually if it takes you a while to make it and you had to work hard to do it, then you keep it a lot better than you do if it comes fast. Fast money coming in is fast money going out in most situations. And so you've got David, and he's got this spoil. He takes it, and my guess is that he took what the king had, and everything else that was in the city, he let the soldiers have. Because you see, that's the way that ancient soldiers got paid. They got paid by what they could take from those they had defeated. So we see that there's a royal ceremony that has taken place. But there's a third thing tonight that I want you to look at, and that's found in our last verse of this chapter in verse 31, and that is a retribution on evil. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I've wrestled with this verse this week. If you were from South Georgia, you'd say, I've wrestled, all right? But I have wrestled with this verse this week because there's two different ways to look at it, all right? Now, I'm going to give you both those ways tonight. Deuteronomy chapter 20, it gives us the prescription from God about how to deal with enemies. In Deuteronomy chapter 20, they were supposed to kill and annihilate the Canaanites. Everybody else, they're supposed to subjugate, right? David does not adhere to that, and I think I know why, and I'm going to give that to you in a moment. But there's two ways to look at this. Look with me at verse 31. And he brought forth the people that were therein, the people of Reba. He brings them out and put them under Saul's and under harrows of iron. And a harrow of iron, it has to do with a spike or spears. And under axes of iron, and made them pass through the brickling or brick kiln. All right? So the first way that you look at that is it says that he put them under saws. That means he turned them into carpenters. He put them under axes of iron. In other words, he sent them out probably with guards to chop trees so that they would have building material. He made them pass or put them under harrows of iron. That's a third thing that they did. And some people look at that as though, well, he put them out in the field so that they could use these farm implements and they could plant things like wheat and rye and barley. Then it says, and made them pass through the brick kiln, or bricklin, if you want to pronounce it that way. That's where they would make brick, just like the ancient Egyptians made the Israelites make brick in Egypt. So now the people of Ammon are going to be doing that. That's a Western way of looking at that. That's a sanitized way of looking at that. Can I tell you, I don't really think that's what happened. I want to give you the second way that you can look at this. I don't think that he just made slaves of them. I think he exterminated them. If you look at this, and let's read it, and you think about this. He put them under Saul's. In other words, you're under a Saul, and you're being sawn asunder. You say, would somebody do something that heinous? Absolutely. There are people that are brutal, and when you're in warfare, it can be brutal. Later on, there's going to be a prophet that'll be in Israel after David. It's a man named Isaiah. And tradition says that Isaiah was taken, stuffed in a log, and sawn in half. And so killing people in a barbarous way was a very common practice in ancient warfare. It struck fear in the hearts of those that they had conquered, but the fear really was not for those people, it was for those that were watching at a distance. If they defeated them and they're treating them like this, we better be careful or that'll be us. So therefore, if you're projecting power, you're projecting the fact that this could happen to you. And so I think that David's men put them under Saul's. I think that they put them under harrows of iron. I think that those spikes and those spears literally were penetrating and stabbing the bodies of the Ammonites. And he put them under axes of iron. They hacked them to pieces. And then made them pass through the brick kiln. Now, what is a kiln? A kiln is an oven. And so therefore, they took people and they put them in ovens. Does that not smack of Nazi Germany? But yet, when you look at this, I really believe that this is what's taking place. Thus he did unto all the cities of the children of Ammon. He didn't just stop here at Reba. every little city. This was the capital. But they began to make their way around to the various cities that belonged to the Ammonites. And they did the exact same thing to those people that they did at the capital city. And I look at that, and in my Western mind, I'm thinking, that is barbaric. It always gave me pause whenever God told Saul to kill all the Amalekites. And he said, you kill the men, you kill the women, you kill the children, you kill the animals. And in my mind, I'm thinking, man, that is tough. But you got to remember that God remembers a long time. Why did God tell him to do that? Why did God say, kill all those Amalekites? Because when they were leaving Egypt, the Amalekites came in from the rear where all the old people were because they couldn't walk as fast as the young people. They were feeble. And they came in from behind and they began to kill and butcher the people of God, and God didn't forget it. And so tonight we read this, and he puts them under the harrows and under the saws and under the axes and sends them through the brick ovens. Why? Well, I want you to go back to 1 Samuel, not 2 Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 11. About, I guess, probably a year and a half maybe ago, 2 years ago now maybe, I preached on this. But in 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse number 2, it says this, and Nahash, the Ammonite, answered them. Who is he talking to? The men of a place called Jabesh-Gilead. Now, these men of Jabesh-Gilead, they are scared of the Ammonites. They're scared of Nahash. They don't want to fight. They know they don't have the manpower. They don't have the weaponry. They don't have the ability to defend themselves. And so they try to offer peace. We will pay you. We'll give you tribute. But I want you to notice the cruelty of the Ammonite leader, Nahash. He answered them, the men of Jabesh-Gilead, on this condition will I make a covenant with you, that I may thrust out all your right eyes. Yeah, I'll make a deal with you. Every one of you men come line up here, and I'm going to take a dagger and we're going to poke your eye out. And he said, and lay it for a reproach upon all Israel. Now, what would that have meant? It would have meant that their God was bigger than the men of Jabesh-Gilead's God. And so you've got the cruelty, the barbarism of the Ammonites. I'll read this to you. You don't have to find it. But in Amos chapter 1, verse number 13, thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of the children of Ammon, and for four. Now, in the book of Amos, you read that phrase often, for three transgressions and for four. And that is a literary or a poetic way of saying time and time and time again. All right? And so for three transgressions and for four of the children of Ammon, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Why? Because they have ripped up the women with child of Gilead, that they might enlarge their border. That's why God said that they needed to be punished. Their transgressions were this. They came into the area that we call Gilead. It's not a city, it's an area. And they would take those women that were pregnant. And they would come through and get those pregnant women, and they would take their daggers and they would cut their bellies open, and their babies would fall out, and the women and the babies would die. That's the children of Ammon. That's the brutality of the children of Ammon. And somebody says, yeah, but aren't we supposed to forgive? Yeah. But there's also a passage in the Old Testament that talks about an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And so you've got God, and evidently he seems to be okay with David doing this. Now I know in our mind, Western thinking, this is a hard passage of scripture. And if you want to believe that they just subjugated him and put him out on the farm and over in the forest, you know, and had him making, you know, log houses, that's fine. But I really believe that they were torturing and killing these people in a heinous way because of the past behaviors of this group of people. God has a long memory. And you and I need to realize that children of God, sometimes they do things that are hard. Everything in your Christian life is not going to be eating ice cream. Sometimes in your Christian life, you're going to go through some deep water. Sometime in your Christian life, you're going to have to make a decision that's going to cause you problem with your friends. Sometimes in the Christian life, if you're going to obey God, you're going to be misunderstood. Do I think that David did right? I don't know. But I know this. I know he did it. And I look at this and I'm just thinking, well, maybe this is going to be on my list of things to ask the Lord when I get to heaven. Because the God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament. We don't believe that they're two separate gods. One God for the old, and he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so, you've got two ways of looking at it. And so they did that to all the cities. And whenever they were done, the Bible says that David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. They didn't have to worry about anybody coming up from the rear because they'd killed them all. Didn't have to worry about, you know, somebody in 20 years growing up because everybody was gone. Perhaps this is one of the ways that David ensured the peace. He would fight battle after battle after battle and get victory after victory. And when Solomon finally takes over, he dwells in peace. You don't find Solomon fighting very often. And so tonight, is this a wag the dog situation? Is this where he's able to say, hey, I've brought some money back to town. Hey, let's go put this in the Lord's treasury. And everybody's saying, man, that's great. Man, look at the victory that's been won for us. And I just can't help but think that in David's mind, he's thinking, whew, all that business with Uriah is now covered. It's water under the bridge. Oh, but as I mentioned a minute ago, God's got a long memory. More on that next time. Let's stand together.